Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village, or what we might call today a community. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Previously, we rounded out Love Month with social entrepreneur Neil Milton, whose childhood trauma impacted his ability to respond calmly as a parent. That compelled him to start his own healing in order to create a safe space for his son to open up about his mental health, and then spawned the Table Talk Project. But what if our approach to parenting needs to consider a brain-first approach? Dr. Catherine Murray taught us that a calm brain is a thinking brain through her research. Well, today, parent coach and therapist for parents of children with neurobehavioral differences, Eileen Devine, is explaining why neurobiology matters and how it can affect the way we interact with our children. Eileen, I was amazed when I came across your work. This is something I've been really interested in over the last few years. Neurobehavioral differences or neurodivergence, this has been words we're hearing quite a lot in the last, you know, 5 years. What is it?
Yeah, great question. What it means is that someone who is living with a brain-based difference, their brain has been changed in structure and function for some reason. We can talk about all the different reasons that that might be the case. They have behaviors that are symptoms of those differences. So that's the behavioral part. So neurobehavioral, brain-based differences with behavioral symptoms.
I actually sat in on one of your workshops recently, and you talk about this behavioral lens versus brain lens. How does that correlate to the neurobehavioral differences we see in children?
Oh, it means everything. It really, truly determines everything. Their experience of the world, their success in navigating the world, and also the parents' success in terms of parenting them in ways that they feel actually help their child. When we look at a behavioral lens, which our society is deeply entrenched in, it's our default lens, it tells us that behavior is willful, that they're being done on purpose, usually to us, with a lot of intent, a lot of thoughtfulness, and that behavior is within someone's control at all times. So that's the behavioral lens. So typically when we see like a child, for example, who's struggling behaviorally, we then try to control their behavior. Everything that we do, all of the behavioral lens approaches, the goal is to change their behavior and to control them as a byproduct of that. If we look at what research tells us about where behavior actually comes from, we get a whole different lens to see that behavior through. We know that behavior is always connected to the brain. For every one of us, whether we fit into that category of neurodiverse or neurotypical, it does not matter. Our brain is always connected to our behavior. So it only makes sense then, if we're considering a behavior, like, why did they do that? Why do they keep doing that? Or why would they ever think that was a good idea? That we also consider, huh, I wonder what that has to do with their brain, right? And I say brain, it's also nervous system stability and fragility, but it's that neurobiology. That's where our behavior originates from. So then it only makes sense that if there's a brain that works differently for some reason, that we see behaviors that reflect that difference. And it helps us so much to understand what that person's experience of the world is, right? If there's a lot of overwhelm, aggression, anxiety, shutting down, withdrawing, it's like, huh, I wonder what is happening with their brain. It's such a better use of our energy to go that direction, because then we can support them in ways that they need to be supported based on their differences versus just trying to stop the behavior and control them with our power, with our control, whatever it is that we can do that with.
How did you first come to understand the difference and do so much research into this topic?
It was a lived experience. I was a clinical social worker before I became a parent, but I had zero experience in this area of clinical work and never imagined that I would ever be doing this work. I have a 17-year-old son who is what society would consider neurotypical. He is my birth child, my biological child. My daughter came to us through adoption as a newborn. She's only 15 months younger. And we recognized very quickly that her development wasn't typical. But it was when she was about 3 or 4 that we really started to see that reflected through very challenging, relentless, exhausting behaviors. I didn't see it that way at the time because I did not have this information. What I saw was a child who was extremely difficult, and I did not know what to do to make it stop. I mean, again, that's what we all know. That's the only lens we have to view it through. Luckily, long story short, I was able to find this information about what if it has to do with her brain. We knew that she was prenatally exposed to substances. We knew she had a brain-based difference. I was able to then find people who could help me link that to the behaviors and help me learn how to parent her differently so that those symptoms calm down. I mean, that was the path towards less challenging behaviors and towards greater connection, more self-esteem for her, less chaos in her home. So that was the way that I learned, I guess what you could say, the hard way, how this all works. But from there, I thought, you know, why isn't anyone teaching this? Like, when you go to the doctor or the neuropsychologist or a therapist or whoever it might be, and you're told that your child has a brain-based difference of some kind, whatever that diagnosis, that label is, why aren't you immediately then given information about how they need to be parented differently? Thinking brain first with the brain in mind versus through this behavior lens. It would save parents so much suffering to have that information. So I thought, well, maybe that's what I should start doing.
I grew up through the late 60s, I was born, and into the 70s. And of course, that was the rise of behavioralist parenting. And yeah. It was, you know, actually a doctor who suggested that these, you know, you needed to control children through consequences. So as a mother and a daughter yourself, how did you model parenting originally? Was it out of your experience growing up with parents who'd come through a type of behavioralist model?
Oh, sure. Oh, through my parents, through the school system. I mean, really, any environment that I spent in time in growing up. And it didn't mean it was harsh behavioralism. Like, I had very kind, loving, attentive parents. I don't have any bad memories of school or the way that I was treated. But the reason for that, I'm convinced, is that I identify as neurotypical. My brain works exactly as society expects it to. So when I was told, don't do that again, or here's your consequence, I could remember the next week when I thought about doing it again, like, oh, nope, mom told me not to. And she said I would get this consequence. I could inhibit my impulse to do that thing and make a better decision. I could connect the dots, A plus B equals C. So that worked for me because I had the skills, cognitive skills, I had the brain that matched that way of parenting, right? So many people who fall out of that very narrow definition of neurotypical do not, and it's not their fault. They're not bad kids. They don't have the skills to meet those expectations, and that's just not recognized by most of our society.
You mentioned earlier, talking about Maya, that her brain had been impacted, and I think it was fetal alcohol syndrome.
Yes, that's her diagnosis.
So you say in your workshop, you know, where the brain has been impacted, there are behavioral symptoms. What other impacts would correlate to some of the behavior symptoms, and what do they look like more commonly in the people you work with?
Yeah, great question. So when I first started doing this work professionally, clinically, I was only working with parents of kids who had been prenatally exposed to substances because I didn't know that there were other diagnoses out there that would align with this model. And then people started to find me and say, oh my gosh, you're talking about, when I was writing blog posts and doing stuff like that, you're talking about my experience. And I was like, really? Like, what's going on with your child? And that's when the floodgates opened And I started to look at the research and see that there were thousands upon thousands of reasons why someone's brain can be changed in function and structure. The most common diagnoses I see or reasons are things like ADHD, things like a traumatic birth, things like prenatally exposed to trauma. So a mom who maybe lived in a very stressful, high stress, toxic stress environment, that changes the developing baby changes their brain. There are also more complex medical conditions, things like neuroimmune illnesses, PANS and PANDAS, where the infection goes to the brain and the brain is inflamed. There are things like seizure disorders. I work with a lot of parents whose kids have uncontrolled seizures. The behaviors all look very similar, right? So autism, PDA profile that a lot of parents resonate with, ODD. I mean, the list goes on in terms of labels that reflect brain differences. The behaviors, there are some distinctions between those diagnoses, but for the most part, there is a lot of overlap. That's why we have so many kids with misdiagnoses as well, where the providers are like, I don't know what's going on. I really can't tell you what this is. The good news for parents is that that really doesn't matter in their day-to-day relationship with their child. What matters is they understand their child's brain works differently, and here are the symptoms. So you asked about what some of those look like. There are some symptoms that are very disruptive to the environment around them, right, to the home. Things like aggression, verbal aggression, physical aggression, or the threat of physical aggression. There can be things like getting stuck in loops, like doing behaviors over and over and over again and not being able to stop, not being able to be redirected. Things like inattentiveness, right? Not being able to stick with a task. There can also be things like not being able to initiate tasks. So it looks like, oh, this child's lazy. They're not motivated. They don't want to do anything. When really they cannot get started on their own because of the way their brain works. The other piece that I always remind parents of is there are also symptoms that are less disruptive, so they get more easily missed, but they're just as distressing for the child. So instead of visual or more visual overwhelm and anxiety, it's this internal meltdown, right? So a shutting down, a more of a collapsed state is how I would describe it. So it can be the whole spectrum. But what that says, when that child is behaving in that way, it's like, oh, they want to do well. This is their distress being reflected clearly to me. What do I know about their brain? Where do they need more support so that we can calm these behavioral symptoms down? That's the goal, right? That's the path.
Firstly, you've just ticked boxes, even going back to my own childhood with some of the aggression and some of the other, you know, symptoms that you explained. But also then I look to my own children, and my son suffered oxygen deprivation at birth. And I see, you know, how we ended up in an ODD situation or oppositional defiance disorder. There was no one around like you then. So how have you been able to develop tools that actually help parents for that, you know, neurobehavioral difference?
Yeah, we always begin with what does the brain do for us? Like, what are cognitive skills? What do we all rely on our brains for, to do for us each day so that we can navigate the world in the most, you know, easeful way possible? And then from there, what do they notice that their child struggles with? So really it's taking inventory of cognitive skills and what then helps them understand whether their child has that skill or not. And what they find through that process is like, oh my goodness, there are so many cognitive skills that my child does not have. That can be a really hard piece for a parent to ease into the acceptance of, right? Because this is a permanent difference where they will need lifelong support. It does not mean that they don't grow and mature in those skills, but they probably will always have some sort of gap in comparison to where the parent imagined they might be, right? So that's the first piece. But the really hopeful news is now they know. They know why, when this plays out, this pattern, this setting, this whatever it might be, why their child always has this meltdown. Why there's always this explosion, when before it was like, oh my gosh, it feels random. It feels out of my control. I can't impact it. So we back up, right? We back into the root cause of it. So when we're looking at, this is what my child's brain does not do, this is where they need targeted support, what expectations do I have of them? in their day, in our day-to-day, getting ready in the morning, you know, doing the bedtime routine, school, all of that kind of stuff. What expectations do I have of them that require these cognitive skills that I now know they do not have independently? And how can I provide scaffolded support and accommodations there so they don't have this chronic frustration that leads to the big blow up? So that's the taking inventory of our expectations. And often what families need to do is greatly adjust the expectations that they have for their child, because they recognize now, like, oh, it's not about their unwillingness. They literally don't have the skills, right? Like, they would do it if they could. They can't do it, not without a whole lot more support than I'd ever imagined. Because the other piece of this, I'll say really quickly, most of the parents that I work with, their kids appear neurotypical, except for their behaviors, right? So they're misunderstood, and they aren't given the accommodations that they need for their disability because they look like every other child, except they're super challenging, right? So again, it just helps us kind of shine light on, no, this is a difference. And what do we do with physical differences for anyone? We give them accommodations. That's what's right. That's what's just. It's what's fair. It's what allows that person to navigate a neurotypical world like we all do, right? So that's the process in a nutshell. It is part of the work that I do with parents. I tell them this up front. This doesn't change overnight. It'll feel like a learning curve. That's because it's complex. We're like unlearning as much as we're learning, but walking alongside them and helping them be patient with the process and lots of self-compassion, right?
When consequential or controlling approaches in parenting don't work, what does? How do you deal with those situations when you're in them once you've identified it's the neurobiology?
Yeah. So there's two pieces, and I talk a lot about what do you do inside of the tricky moments when things have already escalated, and what are you doing outside of the moment? Because outside of the moment is the best place to put our energy. I tell parents all the time, I would never ask you to work harder. Like, you're already working yourself into the ground, trying to figure out how to just calm things down. It's not about working harder. It's about putting that energy somewhere where it'll actually have payoff. So outside of the moment is when there is the reflection, like, what just happened today? Like, why did things go so terribly? What was I asking my child to do? What was the expectation? What was the task? And do they have the skills to do that? Is that where the misalignment was with their unique neurobiology? Oh, dang it. Yes, I see it now. I know better, right? That's where all the self-compassion comes in. They can't do that. They don't have that skill. So next time this inevitably happens, I'm going to be ready. I'm going to proactively put in supports and accommodations, because that is how we reduce the intensity and frequency of those blow-ups in the first place, right? Then you don't have to deal with the intensity of that moment like you are feeling nonstop right now. If the intensity of the moment happens because we are not in charge of our kids' environment 24/7, most of us aren't, right? They may come home to us in a state because they were at school that's like, oh, they're just brain fatigue set in, escalated behaviors. Knowing that those cognitive skills that are already hard for them when they're doing well and they're settled are going to be impossible for them to access. So it is a waste of your precious energy to try to reason and logic and consequence. They can't reflect. They can't hear you and take it in. They can't connect the dots and tell you what they were thinking, right? So in connection with them, co-regulation, helping their nervous system settle so their thinking brain can come online. And then you can circle back and talk about what happened. Instill your values. Help them connect the dots. Help them understand how their actions impact others, right? Those are all cognitive skills, by the way, that we see as character flaws. They're not. They're cognitive skills that many of these kids struggle with. They can't perspective take without a lot of help from an adult helping them get there, right? So those are the ways that I think about the tricky situation and how to address them inside the moment and outside the moment.
Nervous system stability is something that's come up a couple of times during this conversation. How important is that in this whole connection to the neurobiology of the brain?
Yes, it is very, very important. And it really is the reason why I only work with parents versus working with the family unit or working with the child. There are people who do that and they're very skilled, and I'm not saying that's not worth time and energy, but I understand how critical it is for a parent to have a steady nervous system, because when their child has a very fragile nervous system based on their differences, right? They can assume that their child has a fragile nervous system. That's part of this unique neurobiology. Then their child is going to flip into fight or flight or collapse mode, but oftentimes we see fight or flight mode very, very easily. Their perception of threat is what we call faulty, right? So at a physiological level, when the environment is not aligned for them, then they are perceiving threat. They're under this constant stress and they're flipping into fight or flight at this, you know, the drop of a hat, it feels like. What the parent's best parenting tool is in that moment is to ground themselves, have a steady nervous system themselves so that they can be with their child in their distress, attuned to them, and help them come down back into their body and be more steady themselves, right? So it's super easy to attune to our kids when they're doing well. It's very delightful. It's harder. We get triggered ourselves when our kids are triggered. And unfortunately, that's the way nervous systems work, is we're a buffer influence or triggering influence to those around us, right? So that feels like a lot of responsibility, I know. And the goal is not to never get triggered. That's impossible. We're all human. The goal is to understand what triggers us so we can proactively try to study ourselves and understand what it feels like in our body when we get triggered, so we can as quickly as possible come back into regulation and be that steadiness for our kids. So really, really hard to do when you are living with a child who is in chronic dysregulation. That's hard on our nervous system, right? So that's why we talk about resilience building. That's why parents need, really truly need their own support, because it's what we're asking them to do is not easy. It is as hard as they think it is.
Your children, as you mentioned, are now teenagers, and it can be one of the most challenging times in parenting, full stop. But what difference has it made for Maya? How has her life changed?
Oh, it would probably be impossible for me to fully describe it. And I don't say that like being dramatic. Because we had the gift of getting this information when Maya's like 3 or 4, we have been parenting her for most of her life this way. And so being able to know when she has a rough day at school that she is doing the best she can, I have zero doubt about that. And that there's something for us to be curious about in that environment. Like there's something that needs to be tweaked or changed so that she can settle again. Because I've had this experience over and over and over now, confirmed for me that when she is understood and fully accommodated, she does so well. She desperately wants to do well, right? So if you think about when I first learned about her diagnosis when she was, you know, 2, I think, we started reading, of course, and they said, well, she's going to be at high risk for all of these terrible, awful outcomes. I mean, that was truly, and a supportive, loving home is important. I thought, okay, that's not helpful at all. I am convinced that the reason why so many kids with her diagnoses and other diagnoses that are brain-based have these outcomes that they were talking about is because they go through their entire life being misunderstood and not supported and accommodated for their physical difference. So the other piece that has made a huge difference with Maya is she can talk about having a brain-based difference. She will see somebody else who's behaving in a way that looks like maybe they have some neurodiverse traits. And she'll say, do you think they have a brain-based difference? And I said, I don't know. What made you think that? And she can talk about what she sees. And it's not, it's just like, this is how life is. We all have differences of some kind. So she's able to advocate for herself. She's still learning, but she has a lot of knowledge about her differences and what that means for her experience of the world. So in terms of self-esteem, there's no, I'm a bad kid, I'm stupid, I mess up all the time. It's like, oh, I have these differences. Things are a lot harder for me than they are for my brother, for example. And this is what I need to do better. So it reduces the stigma and the shame too.
You've just described a world I'd love to see, Eileen, when differences full stop could be embraced. And I thank you so much for joining me and explaining all of that. I feel like we need to explore some of these topics a little bit more. So would love to have you back on the program sometime this year.
Thank you. I would love to come back. Appreciate you so much for having me. Thank you.
licensed clinical social worker and Brain First parenting specialist in Oregon, USA, Eileen Devine, sharing her very personal and professional experience in neurobehavioral differences. Now, there's more information about her free resources and workshops on her website. Go to eileendevine.com. That's eileendevine.com. You'll find all the links in the episode description. Next week, Christy McVie provides an eye-opening account of her time with the police force in Western Australia, working with victims and perpetrators of child abuse. What she learned needs to be heard if we are to keep our children from harm. Don't forget to share this podcast and be a champion of the change you want to see in our communities. Sign up to the newsletter on my website and search for What We Teach Our Children to join me on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Until then, take care and hug a person you love.